Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 5th of December, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Ariel Rolfe about Rotaract's 4th annual Christmas dinner project. Robert Sewell will be here to talk about Wednesday's concert with the Robert Cohen Quartet. Brian Holst from the Juneau Economic Development Council will be here to talk about next week's Southeast Economic Summit. We'll see the Writers' Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like an decreasing clouds with scattered rain and snow showers in the evening. Forecast for Tuesday, mostly cloudy skies. Tom Matisse from the Juneau City Borough of Juneau called up and said that there was a black ice warning tonight, so please drive carefully. Black ice will be on the road tonight.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native leaders spent last week in Washington, D.C., meeting with the Obama administration and congressional leaders. Matt Laszlo reports on how tribal leaders are reacting to what they heard from the president and his cabinet officials.
For the third time since taking office, President Obama addressed tribal leaders in Washington. In his Friday speech, he announced a new executive order that's intended to increase educational opportunities for American Indian and Alaskan Natives. President Obama told tribal leaders his administration has made gains in Indian country, such as passing the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, but that more is needed.
So we should be proud of what we've done together. But of course, that should sharpen our resolve to do even more. Because as long as Native Americans face unemployment and poverty rates that are far higher than the national average, we're going to have more work to do.
With federal agencies facing as much as 8% in budget cuts, Native leaders are urging the President and Congress to make sure they don't fall hardest on Indian country. Tracy King, President of the Fort Belknap Nations in Montana, says Indian country needs more funds during this economic downturn, not less.
Yes, well, the budget cuts have been disproportionate anyway as well. You know, we usually get about half the funding we need, so cut us more, you know.
Leaders were glad the President addressed them again. But Stuart Bearhart, chairman of the St. Croix of Wisconsin, says he wants more than a speech.
I'd really like the president to come up to Wisconsin and just to show that he really does care about Indian country. You know, go to each region. You know, that's something that all the leaders talk about.
Native leaders also say government-to-government relations have improved with the federal government, but they still want more consultation from the Obama administration. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo.
Canada's top Native leader wants to reset the relationship between First Nations and the government. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the call comes in the wake of a housing crisis on a reserve in northern Ontario.
It's not that common for the Red Cross to come to the rescue of a remote reserve, which is a responsibility of the federal government. But that's exactly what happened after band leaders at Attawapiskat declared an emergency and went through the media for help. Many of the reserve's 2,000 residents live in shacks or houses that need major repair or have been condemned. Some were living in tents, nearly 100 in an abandoned construction trailer. The media attention did get reaction. On the ground, help began to arrive, and in Ottawa, the blame game began. Sean Atleo is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. After calling for a summit on Aboriginal issues for nearly a year, he will now get one in late January with the Prime Minister.
And that we can perhaps consider this moment and the idea of us gathering as a moment to reset the relationship between First Nations and the federal crown. I look forward to our meeting and I look forward to working on a better future together, and that strong First Nations will make for a stronger Canada as well.
After meeting with Prime Minister Stephen Harper in the wake of the Attawapiskat crisis, Atleo says it's evident to everyone that action is needed to deal with long-standing problems facing Native people in Canada. He says what's needed is commitment and action to address systemic problems, and that can only be done by working together. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A new book is out by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to help teach Native children about type 2 diabetes. Coyote and the Turtle's Drum is aimed at 10 to 13-year-olds with the message of leading a healthy lifestyle to help prevent the disease. Animals and human characters are included in the story, which follows a young girl living with diabetes. According to the CDC, Native Americans 10 to 19 are developing type 2 diabetes at higher rates than youth in other racial and ethnic groups. On this day in 1969, the Choctaw Community News was first published. It's a tribal publication of the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you can get free legal help with filing a claim at meetings held around the country through December. Details and a schedule of meetings is at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon, where our first guest is Ariel Rolfe from the organization called Rotaract. Ariel, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
So you're here to talk about the 4th Annual Christmas Dinner Project.
I am, yeah. Capital City Rotaract has been helping with Rachel McLeod to organize 200, or I guess the collaboration of many different people, but we put together 200 boxes of Christmas dinners to pass out around Juneau to families that may not be able to afford it otherwise. And Rachel McLeod has actually been doing this project for, I believe it's 13 years. And so she's slowly passing it on, and we're taking it over.
That's good.
Yeah, and so we work with a few different places around town. Super Bear is one of them, Northland Services and AAA Moving and Storage, and a lot of Rotarians as well. And we collect price mashers. Super Bear lets us use an infinite amount of price mashers and to help lower the costs of all of the food products. And so we ask for people to come and give us price mashers as well as monetary donations.
And how can they do that?
They can mail them to my P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 34361 and Juneau, Alaska 99803. Or we have a few drop boxes around town. We have a drop box at the Jack, at the Jordan Creek Center Mall, and at Menhall Auto Center, and at GCI, and a couple other places I can't think of right now.
Tell me a little bit about Rotaract, if you could.
Sure, yeah. Rotaract is basically a Rotary-sponsored community organization for people between 18 and 30 years old, so male or female can join, and it's real cheap. And we do all sorts of projects around town for community events and fundraising and even some international projects as well.
What have been some recent projects you've been working on?
The most current one that we just finished was the Breast Fest in October, and that one went really well. And it was the Fest for Breast that we had at the Hangar Ballroom, and we raised $6,000 for Cancer Connection, which is a local nonprofit cancer support organization. And that was really fun. And this one, the Rachel McLeod Christmas Dinner Project, which is turning into a holiday dinner project, has been a lot of work, but very fun, and it'll help a lot of people. And we also do Chili Fest every year, which is probably the next project on the agenda, and all sorts of different things. And anytime someone comes up with an idea, we go with that, too.
What attracts you to the organization?
I love to get involved with the community, and Rotaract is a really awesome way to do that. We meet all sorts of people from different places that we might not otherwise be in contact with, and I get to meet all sorts of Rotary members, which is really fun. As an up-and-coming business professional in Juneau, it's nice to make those contacts as well. It's mostly the being able to contribute to places and events in the community and being a part of it. You really feel like you're helping Juneau.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the 4th Annual Christmas Dinner Project, now turned into the Holiday Dinner Project. What was last year's goal, and what's this year's goal?
We try to raise at least $9,000 each year, and that hopefully covers the costs of our Christmas dinner boxes for 200 families. And so each box includes about $50 worth of food. It has a turkey, cranberry sauce, two different types of corn and peas and stuffing and gravy and everything that you could possibly have at your own family dinner for the holiday season. And we try to provide that.
And how can people help out again?
They can either send us some monetary donations or price smashers, and those are really helpful, and turkey smashers as well. Those are both from Super Bear, and they let us use as many as we want of the price smashers and turkey smashers, which help give us a discount on the total cost of it.
All right.
And then we also need volunteers as well. Might as well put that in there for helping pack up all of the boxes. And that's coming up on December 21st. And they can email me or look us up on Facebook to find our webpage as well, which is Capital City Rotaract.
And if people want to mail a donation or a price smasher coupons, how can they do that?
They can mail them to me at P.O. Box 34361, Juneau, Alaska, 99803. And Ariel Ralph.
And Ariel Ralph, thank you very much for coming down to the station and talking about the 4th Annual Holiday Dinner Project. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Thank you. No, just check us out and hope to see everybody at our next event.
'Tis the season at Perseverance Theater with Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Follow the journey of Ebenezer Scrooge as the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future remind him of the true meaning of Christmas. Bring the whole family and celebrate the season with this classic tale. A Christmas Carol runs November 25th through Christmas Eve with a special matinee performance on that day. For more information, visit perseverancetheater.org or call 463-TIXS. Play big at Perseverance Theater.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 5th of December, 2011. It's the birthday of the poet Christina Rossetti, London, 1830, who gave us the Christmas carol in the bleak midwinter. Frosty wind made moan, earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. The travel writer Kate Simon, born Warsaw, 1912, grew up in the Bronx, loved New York, wrote the memoir Bronx, Primitive Portraits of a Childhood. It's the birthday of Calvin Trillin, born Kansas City, 1935. His father was a Ukrainian immigrant, ran a grocery store. Trillin said, "It was a given in our family that my father was a grocer so that I wouldn't have to be." His father read a novel called Stover at Yale, but a young man at Yale decided that his son would go to Yale someday, and so he did, eventually wound up writing for the New Yorker magazine. Calvin Trillin, who said, "The most remarkable thing about my mother is that for 30 years she served the family nothing but leftovers. The original meal has never been found." It's the birthday of Joan Didion, Sacramento, 1934. Shy girl, loved to read, went to University of California, Berkeley, because it was so big she wanted to be anonymous. Won first place in an essay contest for Vogue. Her prize was a job at the magazine, where she started her writing career. She wrote essays about 60s counterculture, but she was an outsider to all of that. She was a Goldwater Republican. 2006, she wrote The Year of Magical Thinking, about the death of her husband, and a couple months ago, a new memoir, Blue Nights, about her adopted daughter, Quintana Roo, who died just before the publication of The Year of Magical Thinking. It's the birthday of Rose Wilder Lane, born in DeSmet, South Dakota, 1886, grew up in poverty with her father, Almanzo, and her mother, Laura Ingalls Wilder. Family struggled with crop failure and terrible debt, finally settled in the Ozarks. And as soon as she could, Rose left home. She went to San Francisco, Paris, New York, Berlin, made her living as a freelance journalist, became one of the highest-paid female writers in the country. In 1930, her mother wrote an autobiography called Pioneer Girl. It was turned down by several publishers, and one of them suggested that she rewrite it as a children's book. And Rose Lane decided to help her mother with the rewriting. And together they created The Little House on the Prairie books. Nobody is sure how much the daughter influenced the book. She was at least the editor, sometimes the ghostwriter. She wrote to her mother about some changes. A good bit of the detail that I add to your copy is for pure sensory effect. And her mother replied, "Do anything you please with the damn stuff if you will fix it up." But clearly, without Rose Wilder Lane, the Little House books would probably not exist. Here's a poem for today by Mark Irwin, entitled Domestic. December, and it would be a Saturday, some milk out for the cat as the long gray evening expires with snow. He would read, and she would color, her face pressed right up against the window of the paper. What does she see? Her little heart, one joy, as the crayon thick sun pours yellow out onto the green trees and large white box, beneath whose triangular hat they will argue, love, dream, fight, and grow up in. House. The very words of breathing out, of so much breathing in, a book, a brain, a wild brilliance of light, trying to comprehend the dark air. Domestic, a poem by Mark Irwin, from Quick Now, Always, published by Boa Editions Limited, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, combining the power of email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on your clock. ConstantContact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KRNN's performance series continues as the Gold Town Nickelodeon as Take 5 goes live. The Robert Cohen Quartet plays excellent jazz Wednesday, December 7th from 7 to 9 p.m. with Cohen on keyboards, Adrian Minney on bass, Clay Good on drums, Doug Bridges on sax, and others. Be there. That's Wednesday, December 7th, 7 to 9 at the Gold Town. Tickets available at ktoo.org and at the door.
And there's some music from the Robert Cohen Quintet, a quartet back then, in the studio with me now is Robert Sewell. He's going to be hosting this Wednesday's live, Take 5 goes live at 7 o'clock at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater. Robert Sewell, thank you for coming down the station today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for KTOO and KRNN sponsoring the event.
Paint us a picture of what's going to be happening on Wednesday night.
Wednesday night, December 7th, it's a night that will not live in infamy, is the second of a continuing series of events featuring local musicians. There was one on bluegrass and old time about a month or two ago that was very solid success. The place was packed. This is the second in that continuing series, and this one's just on jazz. It features Robert Cohen on keyboard with Adrian Minnie on bass, Clay Good on drums, and Doug Bridges on saxophone, a person whom I feel to be a state treasure. He and Robert Cohen are spectacular musicians. They, along with Kari Groovin, I suppose, could play anywhere. They could go to L.A. and be very successful session musicians. So I imagine there will be a lot of ideas thrown in. Clay Good on drums and Adrian Minnie on bass have played with Robert Cohen in a variety of settings over the years. What we just heard was Gin Risica. That was from another Take 5 live event in 2006 at Jaded. Very successful. On that night, it was Justin Oldham on bass instead of Adrian Minnie, which was fine. But looking for something special here this coming Wednesday night.
It's a night of instrumental jazz.
Exactly right. No, as far as I know, Robert is the maestro in the whole thing, but Mr. Cohen may elect to have whoever he wants join him on stage, but I think it's just strictly an instrumental night.
It starts at 7 o'clock at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater, and tickets are available at kto.org or even at the door if you're lucky enough to get them at the door, because last time we did a concert like this, as you mentioned, it sold out, packed the house, in fact.
It did, yeah. This will be a very different kind of event. It's more of a performance rather than a jam, which is Robert can do anything, meaning Mr. Cohen, but he's elected to have this be more of a performance, and it probably will sell out.
It's a benefit for KRNN.
Yes, it's a neat way for KRNN to do more of what it always has done, but this is a deliberate step towards more of a direct involvement with the community, more an involvement with local musicians and local culture. I'm thrilled. I think Cheryl Levitt should definitely also get some solid credit for moving this ahead. Colette Costa has been managing the Goldtown Nickelodeon, and she's four square involved with this, so it should be a hoot. Your ticket also gets you a beer, wine, and there's light hors d'oeuvres. That's part of the deal, so it's a good deal, good music.
So yeah, you're not a musician, but you probably know, can talk extemporaneously. How do you take a jazz standard and give it color?
Well, the jazz standard is something that we often hear on Take 5, and there were a few last night. But a jazz standard might have come from anything, from pop music. It might have been a folk song. Could have been something from opera, such as Porgy and Bess. And some of those tunes developed a life of their own that lasted far beyond the initial personnel. And what in jazz, what that is basically a structure. They call it a head, where there's essentially some of the melody, maybe some of the harmonies, introduce the tune. And then from there, a wide variety of things can happen. Oftentimes there are solos taken by some of the different performers. And the key from then on is throwing in ideas, essentially. It's improvisation. It's something fairly free-form around a structure. And oftentimes, then, eventually the tune comes back to the head two or three times and oftentimes closes hearkening to it, kind of a reprise. But for me, the thrilling thing about jazz and how that standard is given color is the improvisation, the things that the accomplished musician can throw in. Sometimes they're humorous, references to other things, wide variety of things. Sometimes they're extended meditations or iterations of a rhythm. It can be all kinds of stuff. But somebody like Robert Cohen or Doug Bridges, they're so facile, they're so quick in the execution of their song. The mechanics are all way behind them. Then they basically play whatever occurs to them, and oftentimes with no charts. I mean, typically with no charts, although both of them are excellent readers. And they listen to each other very well, as do the other two, as do Adrian Minney and Clay Good. That's also part of the thrill, I think, in jazz, is to watch the collaboration, to notice how they play off of each other. And sometimes it even amuses or thrills the performers themselves, and you'll see them crack a smile or respond musically. So that's how you color it up. That's partly what jazz is, I think.
I'm talking with Robert Sewell, a longtime fixture on KRNN Radio and also KTUO. It was a program called Take Five on Sunday nights from 7 to 9 o'clock. And this Wednesday night at 7 o'clock is going to be a Take Five Goes Live to the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater starting about 7 o'clock. And it's going to be it's not going to be just music, though. You're going to have a little conversation thrown in there as well.
Yes, that's right. We will. What will we do? It will be Colette, Costa, and myself. And I'll do most of the kind of the, as it were, the interviewing piece. But Colette won't be able to help herself, and there'll be various kinds of humorous interludes. She is extremely, extremely quick-witted, and so I look forward to all that. But in terms of just raw smarts, Robert Cohen is also, in addition to being a great performer, is a very smart man. And he does know the music solidly. So it'll be fun to talk to him a little bit about music. You know, jazz is something that has 125-year history now. It has roots that are part. In fact, last night on Take Five, we did a roots music thing, Terry Camry and I, on ragtime. Ragtime, field holler, work songs, the blues, actually some classical music. All these things have contributed their own influences into jazz. And then over the years, of course, jazz has evolved. There's been various epics. Cohen knows all those epics, but ragtime led to very so-called early jazz. There's some, you know, influences from Dixie, from New Orleans, and later on there was swing, then bop, then hard bop and post-bop, and then there's fusion, and, you know, like in the 60s and 70s, and there was acid jazz, and then increasingly there's been a world influence, meaning other cultures. Latin jazz would be an example that have had a significant impact on what jazz has become in the United States, but it's still an American genre. It's still an American idiom, and Cohen knows all those things, and that's where some of the ideas come from. They throw in, it's not quotes, but sometimes they can be. Other times it's just a trend or a harmonization or a rhythm.
You can catch it all this Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Golden Nickelodeon Theater. Tickets are in advance at $12, and $15 is at the door. You need to get them soon because this is a show that might sell out because due to limited seating at the Golden Nickelodeon.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
So good food and good people and good
yeah, each one of the people are very interesting. As people, too, you know, on drums, Clay Good, he's been here in Juneau for a long time. He was many people will remember him as a science teacher at JDHS, now retired, but he leads a very active life, and he's remained very much involved with music, which is cool. But he's a very interesting person also, and a good longtime collaborator with Robert Cohen. I interviewed him some years ago for an article, and I mentioned to Clay that they do such an excellent job listening to each other. He shrugged his shoulders and he says, "Have to. We don't practice much." everybody's always doing something. So
We've been practicing getting ready for the Wednesday gig at 7 o'clock at the Cold Town Nickelodeon Theater. It's a benefit for KRNN. Robert Sewell, thank you so much for coming down the station, and thank you for being a host for this Wednesday night's performance, which is going to be taped and heard later on at some point on KRNN.
Delighted. Thanks for having us in.
Music of Robert Cohen and friends. They'll be performing this Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Cold Town Nickelodeon Theater in a benefit concert for KRNN. Tickets are $12 in advance and available at ktuo.org and also at the door for $15. In studio with me now is Brian Holst, Chairman of the Juneau Economic Development Council, here to talk about the Southeast Economic Summit, Tuesday, December 13th from 8 to 5, Centennial Hall, about a week from now. Brian, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be here. And I'm the director. The chairman is Kurt Fredrickson. I don't want to get ahead of myself here.
That's okay. You do fine in your job as you do. What defines the Southeast Economic Summit?
This is a gathering of industry clusters that we've been working on for the past year. So we're bringing together. It's a discussion about how do we strengthen the economy in Southeast Alaska. And for the last year, we've been working with four different industry groups that are important in the region. And so this is a chance to bring all those groups together.
And those four groups are?
The ocean products industry, the visitor products industry, the forest products industry, and an industry that is really nascent in the region, but some people believe have potential, which is the renewable energy industry. Hydropower, of course, is already in play here in Southeast Alaska, but we're talking about the other alternative and clean energy industries apart from hydro.
What's happened in past summits, and how is this one going to be different?
Well, this is the first time that we've had an event like this. As I mentioned, we've spent the last year working with these clusters, and we're bringing a new concept to Alaska and to our region. The economic clusters are not new to the world. This is a concept that clusters occur naturally in the economic environment. And because a cluster simply, it's a set of firms in the same or related field located in a similar geographic area that are linked by service or supplier relationships and share a same labor market. And within that, the firms complement, but they also compete with one another. So what cluster work is identifying those key industries in our region. And there are more than that, but we've identified these key industries. And then what cluster work does, and what we've been doing the past year, is actively encouraging collaboration within the cluster. So the ocean products industry, they've been collaborating at some level together for years and years and years, and continue to do so. What a cluster effort does is recognize that this is an important industry, and then we provide additional support and further collaborating to identify those key priorities that will strengthen their strengthen those industries even more. And in that process, we include not just people that participate in the industry directly, but also supporting organizations like banks, for example, or importantly, state or federal regulators, and in some cases even associations. It could be nonprofits, environmental NGOs, or other business associations.
And your keynote speaker is in the food processing industry.
That's right. And really, the reason we selected David Click is because he has a 20 years of experience working in clusters in Oregon, and he works in a food processing cluster, economic cluster. And so since the concept is new, the cluster development is new to our region, we thought it would be wise to bring somebody who has worked in this for a long time to be able to talk to business leaders about the value of collaborating. I think, Jeff, I think, as you know, a lot of people hold lots of meetings with a lot of promise that this is going to be different and something good is going to happen from that. And we're also trying to do the same thing. And quite frankly, we recognize that it's important to bring some expertise and outside perspective to be able to share with people so that people can understand that this perhaps indeed is worth their effort and their time. And it's a long-term strategy that produces results. And there are a lot of results from the Oregon area that he's going to share with us.
Besides people in the industry, who else do you hope will attend?
Well, this is an event that is focused on businesses and business leaders. Of course, it's an event that is open to the public because, you know, business operates in an ecosystem that includes various stakeholders. But we're primarily asking for and reaching out to business people to attend the event. We have federal officials have agreed to come and be present as well, state officials as well, because part of what we're trying to do is provide an opportunity for these business leaders to articulate what their priorities are, and then have an audience, have the government officials be able to listen to them and hear directly from industry. These are things that you could do to help us to be more successful in our work, and then have government respond by, you know, adapting their programs, adjusting, aligning their resources to better allow industry to be successful. And if I can go on just a little bit more, just the reason that's so important in our region is that we live in Southeast Alaska. 95% of the land is owned by the federal government. Much of our oceans, of course, is managed by non-private sources, by state as well. And so collaboration between government and industry is really critical. And this is one of the objectives of this meeting is also to ensure that dialogue occurs in a very constructive way.
What are some of the major economic issues that unify and also divide Southeast Alaska?
I think the biggest issue that in the region that I think we all struggle with is resource development and what that means. I think business leaders when we ask business leaders what are the main issues that are important to that you face operating your business in Southeast Alaska, what are the main benefits of operating your business, and they'll say cultural opportunities and recreational opportunities. It's clear in our survey results that in general the business community loves the environment just as much as everyone else. The challenge is that balance, I think, between developing resources, mining, timber, seafood, these abundant resources we have, and also maintaining the commitment to stewardship that I think everyone in Alaska feels is very important.
What's the schedule for the economic summit?
It's an all-day event. In fact, we start the night before at a little reception where people that are attending the summit can meet Dave Click and others on Monday evening. But the main event is from 8 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Centennial Hall. It is open to the public. We're asking people to register. You can register at our website at jedc.org. No fee to attend. We're hosting this event because we really believe this sort of dialogue is really critical to having successful and sustainable industry development in our region. An event is going to be, the details of the event are on our website at jedc.org, but basically what we're going to have in the morning is an opportunity for the industries to meet as individual industries, ocean products, visitor products, and forest products, and renewable energy. In the afternoon, we're going to have an opportunity for people to address cross-cutting issues across these industries, you know, workforce development issues, public relations challenges that industries face, the research and development, technology transfer issues that are across industries, access to financial resources, which are also all common issues that are across various industries. We're also going to be looking at biomass as a potential industry in the afternoon. And then near the end of the day is when we're going to have a state and federal government officials interacting directly with industry leaders, talking about challenges that they face and looking for ways that they can collaborate.
I've been talking with Brian Holst from the Juneau Economic Development Council about the Southeast Alaska Economic Summit, which is happening this next Tuesday, December 13th, from 8 o'clock until 5 p.m. at Centennial Hall. The big question, of course, is what about lunch?
Lunch. Thank you for asking that. Southeast Conference is providing lunch. That's one of their contributions as a partner in this to this process. So please register online if you want to join us for a simple lunch.
If people want to be prepared, is there a homework they should do?
You know, it's interesting. It would be you don't have to do anything. But on our website, we have resources about industry clusters. And while it's a very simple concept, it would be very, very worthwhile to read a little bit about what is cluster development and why it's worked elsewhere. And what we're doing here, Jeff, is we're not trying to do something new or fancy. We haven't created anything new. We've gone and we've seen what do other regions in the world, in the nation, what are they doing that's making them be successful economically? And organizing themselves around cluster development is one of those tools that other people are using very successfully. So we're taking that tool and bringing it here to the region to see if we can't see some greater competitiveness brought to our industries, which will, in the end, raise the standard of living and the prosperity of everyone in Southeast Alaska.
But how many people do you see attending?
We have 90 people confirmed already, which we're very pleased at. We were hoping for 100. Looks like we're going to meet our goal and perhaps some. You know, it's a day full of discussion and interaction. So we don't want 1,000 either, but we certainly have capacity for anyone that's interested in coming, especially those business leaders that and people working in business that are curious about this sort of engagement. One of our goals of having this summit is that we allow people to take a look at this sort of process and see for themselves if they believe this is worthwhile or is this just another set of conversations that may not go anywhere. We believe that this is extremely worthwhile and that businesses will see positive results from this sort of engagement.
It also seems like an event that anybody going who might want to attend is even if they're not a major holder in a business.
Absolutely. You will learn a tremendous amount about the economy in Southeast Alaska, and you will hear directly from business leaders what they see as the issues that are important to them to be more successful. So, yes, I'm not trying to discourage the general public from coming, but what I am trying to do, Jeff, is to really encourage business leaders that tend to be skeptical of these sort of processes to come on out and trust us. I hope if I can say that this is a worthwhile process and come to decide for themselves.
All right, and that happens Tuesday, December 13th. If people need more information, they could check out your website, which is?
JEDC.org.
All right. Is this complicated? Do you need a scientist to explain it?
Complicated
reading for the
absolutely not. No, I even though I can barely understand a simple question from you, I can even understand this stuff. So it's certainly within the, and we have several documents online, from short descriptions that we put on our website to various documents and links to studies from Michael Porter that's going to great depth, to documents from the National Governors Association, Brookings Institute. Several organizations have looked at this and provided their own opinions about cluster development.
All right, Brian Hulse from the Juneau Economic Development Council. Anything you'd like to add on what I forgot to ask?
No, thank you for giving us the time. We just think this is a way to constructively engage with our business community to increase prosperity in Southeast Alaska. Hope people can come out.
Is your phone number for people can call?
Yes, 523-2300.
All right, thanks, Brian, for coming by.
Thank you.
Support comes from McDonald's, now serving holiday treats, eggnog shakes, peppermint mochas, and peppermint hot chocolate. McDonald's is open daily in the Valley except Thanksgiving and Christmas Day.
This is Bird Note. Have you ever watched ducks walking around in freezing temperatures and wondered how they keep their feet from freezing? The ducks seem oblivious to the cold, even as they stand on ice-covered lakes and streams. Or perhaps you've been concerned that the tiny feet of songbirds will freeze to metal perches. Unlike our feet, birds' feet are little more than bone, sinew, and scale, with very few nerves. But it takes more than a lack of nerves to keep their feet from freezing. A miraculous adaptation called rete mirabile is responsible. This fine net-like pattern of arteries that carry warm blood from the bird's heart is interwoven with the veins carrying cold blood from the feet and legs. This interweaving warms the cold blood in these veins before it reaches the bird's heart. This system keeps the bird's legs and feet warm, even without leggings and slippers. And those little songbirds' feet? Don't worry. Birds' feet lack sweat glands and stay dry, so there's no danger of them freezing to metal perches. What was that called again? Rete mirabile. I'm Michael Stein.
Time is 3:57 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Local resident Dan Hobson just came out with a brand new CD called Solo Classical Guitar. It's a selection from it now. And you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau, Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valleyanok Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemina, Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet at Nicey Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. Also live online at www.ktoo.org. Tom and Denise from the city in Juneau called up recently to remind us that with colder temperatures and water on the ground that there's a great danger of black ice tonight, so please drive carefully. Tomorrow at 3 on KTOO News, Pat Moore will be your host for Juneau Afternoon. He'll talk with conductor Sally Smith about the Juneau Lyric Opera's Holiday Pops concert this weekend. Becca Parks will be here to highlight this week's first LEGO League competition. Photographer Matthias Brutter will be here to talk about the joys and challenges of wildlife photography in Alaska. Janelle Panella and Linda Curtis will give us a taste of Saturday's holiday cooking and self-care classes at Rainbow Foods. Karen Smolin, Career Technical Education Coordinator from the Juneau School District, will be here to talk about second semester high school after-school classes. And next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today, and have a great evening, and drive and walk carefully.
Thousands of protesters fill the streets in Moscow after parliamentary elections.
Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's party is accused of rigging the vote.
It's Monday, December 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Coming up, allegations of ballot box stuffing that helped Russia's pro-Kremlin party.
Also this hour, a push by police departments to fly drone aircraft over the skies of the U.S.
How Tennessee is holding its public universities accountable for graduation rates.
And we'll hear about salaries for presidents of private universities. A growing number of them make more than $1 million a year.
Students who are frustrated with tuition rising and other economic problems will look at their presidents and question the level of pay.
First, this hour's news.